It's time for Tweet This Week in Tech, a big week, and we've got the best here to talk about it. Denise Howell from This Week in Law, Natalie Morris from NBC, and of course, Tim Stevens from CNET. We'll talk about the Supreme Court Aereo decision, Google I.O., and a new world record in Super Mario. It's all coming up next. Tweet.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 464, recorded June 29th, 2014. My Wi-Fi Moomoo. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Lynda.com. Learn what you want when you want with access to over 2,400 high-quality online courses, all for one low monthly price. To try it free for 7 days, visit Lynda.com/twit2. That's Lynda.com/twit and the number 2. And by NatureBox. Order great-tasting, healthy snacks delivered right to your door. Forget the vending machine. Get in shape with healthy, delicious treats like roasted garlic, pumpkin seeds. To get 50% off your first box, go to naturebox.com/twit. That's naturebox.com/twit. And by Personal Capital. With Personal Capital, you'll finally have all your financial life in one place and get a clear view of everything you own. Best of all, it's free. To sign up, go to personalcapital.com/twit. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show where we take all the tech news of the week, we masticate, we genuflect, we eradicate, I don't know, we do a bunch of stuff to it and we spit it out in your little bird-like mouth. Joining...
We regurgitate.
That's the regurgitation. Bravo, sure. Thank you. That's Natalie Morris, who is A+ in bird biology. Natalie's a contributor to NBC, a longtime friend of the show, many times on the show. It's great to have you back. Looks like you're in Lake Tinky Winky.
No, I'm not.
Oh, you're home.
I'm in New Jersey.
Why are you not at Lake Tinky Winky on this 4th of July weekend?
Well, you know, my husband works for a news channel, so when it's a holiday for everyone else, it's usually not for us. So he works when there's holidays.
As a longtime broadcaster, I always work holidays and weekends. It's terrible.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
You don't have them off.
No.
But don't cry for me, Argentina, because I get to be on Twit.
Actually, Argentina plays tomorrow, I think, so don't worry about that one. Also here, Denise Howell wearing her EFF t-shirt. She's, of course, the host of This Week in Law, blogger at Bags and Baggage, and we just love Denise.
Hi, it's great to be back.
A practicing working attorney on the show. What a thought.
Yes.
That's why you're here today, because the Supreme Court's been busy and we need your help.
They have been busy.
We also welcome Tim Stevens from Engadget. I'm sorry, CNET.
There you go.
Rewind. I was living in the past.
It's only been a year now, Leo.
One of these days, I'll figure it out.
You can rewind a little bit and give me the CNET title.
You both. Had you ever worked for CNET, Denise? We'll have the. Because I worked for CNET too.
I worked for ZDNet. Well, I blogged for them.
That's close enough.
That's close enough, right?
Same.
Are you part of the Facebook page? There's a ex-CNET employee Facebook page. No, I'll have to sign up.
I would win a prize because I was the fourth employee of CNET.
Are you part of that page? I'll invite you.
I want to be on that page because it was Shelby Lyman and the weirdo. And what was the other guy? I've forgotten him. He got in trouble with the state of California for not paying his taxes. He bought a racehorse because he looked it in the eyes and he could see it was a winner. I forgot his name.
I can't. It just keeps me.
You know who I'm talking about.
Oh, his reputation precedes him. Yes.
Halsey Miner.
That's it. Yeah.
And I remember he told me there that Halsey Miner at the University of Virginia, there's a Halsey Hall and a Miner Hall, and they're right across the street from because his family is an old Virginia family. He comes from money. And I was like the fourth employee. It was just the two of them when I was hired to be the VP of programming for 1 week. And was out the door.
And that was it? Were you there when Ryan Seacrest was there?
Oh, no. He came after me. I did their first pilot with Dvorak. And I go way back. But that's a long and boring story. Let's get into the news because there's a lot of it. We'll be talking about Google I.O. in a bit. And I do have the most valuable gimme. You know, every year at Google's developer conference, they give away notebooks, they give away phones, they give away the Google Q, which they never even sold. That's got to be worth something if you still have your Google Q. But this year, yeah, you got Android Wear watches, sure. But more to the point, you got Cardboard.
Mm.
You have yours, Tim, because you were at Google I.O.
I do, yeah. I actually haven't opened mine yet, so it's still in the folded-up form, totally unopened. I'm going to shrink-wrap that thing. I'm going to go down to the comic book store and get one of those acid-free baggies, I think, and put it in there.
You should.
Store it for a couple decades. It's,
we just checked on eBay, $86 for Google Cardboard unopened. Assembled, I think, is going to have it's less valuable, but unopened.
I actually did run out of them. I know some people who were at the keynote who came out the door too late and weren't able to get them. So you did have to get out there early.
Oh, I got mine. Gina and Jeff were there. I wasn't there, but they gave me mine. This was a flat piece of cardboard. Gina took the time to assemble it in the car ride up here. It's got a little magnet thing on the side with a rubber band. It's got some plastic lenses. That's the only thing that'd be hard to get. They do have the plans online. And then you could either go to a website or download on the Google Play Store the free Cardboard app. You put on your smartphone, it has to be an Android phone, you put the smartphone in here. It senses that it's in the box. And it gives you a VR view. And I think the whole thing is that for $150, they made something that's worth, that does the same thing Oculus Rift does for $2 billion. Because it does. It's stereo?
It's pretty impressive.
It's actually
it's
better.
Pretty great how they're able to pull that together for something so cheaply. And people were very excited to see it. I mean, I tweeted when I got mine, and I don't know how many hundred retweets I got out of that thing. But yeah, it is an interesting way to get VR in the hands of more people. I mean, people have certainly heard about VR for a long time, and not everyone has had the chance to try out Oculus. And, you know, this isn't as good as Oculus, but it's certainly
I think it's better than Oculus. How is it not
really?
As good? So here's Oculus. Well, this is – okay, so – it's using an Android phone. Apparently, that's enough compute power to do what Oculus does. This was the very fun thing they put out on the Moto X, where it's a game where you look around and you follow a hat. It's called Windy Day. But if you put it in here and you don't let your camera fall out, as you look around, I wish you could see this, but you're looking around. You look down, you look up. There's the hat. Where'd it go? Wait a minute. And the accelerometer in the phone, it works.
How big is that? Because Android phones vary so much in size.
Yeah, this is a 5-inch. This is the HTC One. It's 5 inches, but it would fit a variety. As you can see, it's, you know, I don't think it would make the 6 inches.
It scales
because it's got little lenses. And you know what? How is it not as good as Oculus Rift?
I just don't think that the optical quality is quite as good as an Oculus, given that it's dealing with multiple size phones, and I think the lenses are a little bit cheaper. But yeah, I mean, it's 9/10 of the way there for, like you said, a small fraction of the cost. It's the kind of thing that you can ship somebody in the mail for, you know, $125, and they can get a feel for what VR is like, yeah. And know whether or not they should get excited about it.
And who doesn't have an Android phone? You could do this. And somebody said, well, your arms get tired. Well, it'd be easy enough to glue a little rubber band, you know, strap. Actually, I have a rubber
duct tape. It'll work too.
Put this on.
Where did I get that? And then, you're going to get more grief from wearing that than wearing glass.
I just thought that's Google's had problems because they give away such great stuff. You know, they gave away thousands of dollars worth of stuff last year that nobody can get in anymore. They had to have a lottery to get in. I think half the people going there aren't developers. They just want free crap. So give away Cardboard and maybe it'll be easier to get into developers conference. And frankly, this is giving me a lot of joy, as you can see.
They either wanted free stuff or they wanted to protest, one or the other. But right. Those were the two hot tickets, either Cardboard or protesting.
Yeah, we noted that Google at the beginning of the I.O. keynote noted that 20% of the attendees of Google I.O. this year were female. But I want to point out that 50% of the protesters were female. So there's still some catching up to do. Oh, here's my Oculus Rift.
Now, we got tweeted... from, let's see, who is this? G. Rajib on Twitter that the Dodo case people are making their own model
awesome.
And they're calling it the Google Cardboard VR Toolkit for $19.95.
Perfect.
Not bad. Cheaper than eBay.
And there's no wires. It's wireless. They have a museum tour. They have a tour of Versailles. I mean, I think this does everything the Oculus Rift does. Anyway, that's enough of that. We'll talk about what Google announced at Google I.O. because it's a kind of a mishmash, and I want to get everybody involved in that. But before we do, we should talk about the Supreme Court because The SCOTUS was a little bit busy on Friday with two, I think, important rulings. One may be a landmark ruling. But let's start with the less important ruling, and that's the one that's got all the geeks ahead up, and that's the Aereo ruling. Now, Denise had a great This Week in Law on Friday discussing the Aereo ruling, and I certainly point you to that show if you want to really go into detail. But it's called Monkeys, Ducks, and Unicorns. And one of your guests was Sonia West, was from the University of Georgia, right?
Their school of law.
She was an expert on this whole issue. But maybe, Denise, you can kind of summarize, what did the Supreme Court rule?
Well, the Supreme Court tried to do something very limited and say that somebody who is doing what Aereo does in the way Aereo does it is directly infringing copyright law by engaging in a public performance of the copyrighted works, here the free over-the-air broadcast television that Aereo was providing to its customers via its series of tiny dime-size antennas.
ABC had sued saying that Aereo is illegally retransmitting ABC television programming via the local television stations.
Right, ABC and other networks. And it's been a very long and arduous and multi-jurisdictional world of litigation around this issue, because Aereo is not the only company that has tried going after this using this kind of technology. So we've had some conflicting decisions from around the country at the federal court level. And what the Supreme Court was specifically looking at was an injunction against Aereo that was declined to be put in place by the New York Federal Court of Appeal.
The lower court said Aereo was okay.
Said Aereo was okay for now, doesn't need to be enjoined. We're still going to have a trial on all these copyright issues. But what you haven't done, broadcasters, is show a strong likelihood that you're going to be able to demonstrate at trial that Aereo directly infringed copyright. And that's a big distinction, whether Aereo directly infringed or whether its users are somehow engaged in copyright infringement. Because when you think back on the history of the kinds of copyright cases the Supreme Court has considered, you think about the Grokster case, you think about the Betamax case way back then, we're talking about things that could be copyright infringement by the users, but the person supplying the intermediary technology may or may not be responsible for what the users are doing. And here the direct question before the court was, is Aereo itself performing? We know there's a performance going on of the copyrighted works that the broadcasters are putting out there. But is Aereo doing that performance, or is the performance happening on the viewer side? And that turns out to be a very important distinction under copyright law.
So the fact that Aereo won this decision, all that means, does that mean now that the injunction will be in effect? It means that Aereo has to go back to the lower court.
Means that Aereo has to go back to the lower court.
The trial
is
still on. There still will be a trial, right?
Right. And under this decision from the Supreme Court, there should be an injunction against Aereo's near live broadcast aspect of Aereo's business.
And so Aereo has just kind of unilaterally decided to suspend business.
Which is sad, because if they don't go ahead and litigate out the issues in this case, we're not really going to reach the complicated nuances here that I think, you know, still need to be explored. The Supreme Court looked way back to the late 60s and 70s before the 1976 Copyright Act and said, basically, the majority opinion authored by Justice Breyer said, you know, our hands are kind of tied, because we had some opinions that we, the Supreme Court, our predecessors on the Supreme Court, authored way back in the late 60s and the 1970s that looked at the community access
television system, the old cable system, where people would put antennas on hills because people did not have good reception at their homes and not powerful enough, amplified enough reception to really make use of free over-the-air broadcast television. And we had decided in a couple of those decisions that there wasn't a public performance going on. There wasn't a performance going on at all. And you know what Congress did? They came in 1976 and undid those decisions. That
they gave the copyright owner exclusive right to perform the copyrighted work publicly.
Right. And they decided that cable companies were actually doing that, and that if that's the case, and then, you know, you were talking before the show about now all the regulations and requirements that are incumbent on cable companies because of the role that they are playing in passing along the signal, the free broadcast over the air television signal to their customers. So the court went through some really strange machinations of, you know, just couldn't really, I think, get its head around Aereo's technology very well, or the fact that Aereo's technology should be treated different than an antenna on
okay,
a hill
so
that lots of people are sharing.
That's point one. And I mentioned before we began that I think my position on this is contrarian to what most geeks feel like. Because I think geeks love the Aereo. They love the idea of screwing the cable company, screwing the networks. Nobody loves either. And why shouldn't we be able to pay $8 and be able to watch TV over the air using these antennas? But it strikes me as Aereo's doing exactly what the original cable system was supposed to do. The cable,
which is why we heard so many of the dissent, and most of the judges actually who ruled for this, like Justice Sotomayor, was saying, like, she kept scratching her head, saying, "Why is this not a cable company?
How is this not different?
A cable company,
yeah.
Right? When if you really look into the technology, clearly it's not a cable company.
I disagree. I think it's exactly the same thing as community access television. I think it's exactly the same thing. Now, understand cable don't do it this way anymore. But in the original days, as Denise was saying, they put up an antenna because you couldn't get it. And they ran a cable to your house. And everybody who subscribed to that cable company used that antenna.
But everybody didn't have their own antenna.
Well, first of all,
right. And your time
first of all, I know
an
this
antenna,
wasn't art.
So you have the same right to it in the way that you don't with a cable company. It's a lot like a timeshare, like those timeshare solar gardens that are popular
okay.
these days. Like
first,
you're paying into
first,
the hardware.
What? How does this change your argument? If the dime size antennas are lies, does this change your argument?
No.
Okay, because I want to point out that antenna experts have said, and I'll point you to this article from Pete Putman, HDTVExpert.com, that in fact, it's not possible that these dime-size antennas could effectively receive the transmissions. They're too small. They're probably acting as an array, despite what Aereo says. Now, I admit this was not argued in court. In fact, what the court decided is we're not even going to think about the technology. Let's just see the end result. And I think the court probably was right, because you could debate this issue, the dime-size antenna issue, till the cows come home. But they stipulated that Aereo was telling the truth. I don't think Aereo is telling the truth. The Aereo is doing two things to get around the Copyright Act. One is the dime-size antennas. Two is a six-second delay. But in fact, isn't it doing exactly the same thing as a cable company does, really? From the point of view of the user, from the point of view of everybody else.
Certainly the majority of the Supreme Court felt that way.
I think they got it right.
Very well-reasoned Scalia dissent points out why we shouldn't consider it that way. Justice Scalia, joined by Justices Thomas and Alito.
The most conservative members of the court.
Right, exactly.
And I think they were giving a constructionist argument. I don't think that they were arguing in favor of the technology, but they just were uncomfortable with the court overreaching.
And I think they were worried about the precedent in cloud
right.
computing in mm-hmm. general, because in this way we can call iTunes Match a cable company if you and I just play the same album at the same time. We're forgetting about the
But we
the
pay
users.
For it, and iTunes pays for it. It's
yes.
There is, and so I think Aereo gets around this and knew it from the beginning by paying retransmission fees like a cable company, and then it's all legal.
Here's what Justice Scalia would say to you, Leo. He says, I share the court's evident feeling that what Aereo is doing or enabling to be done to the network's copyrighted programming ought not to be allowed. But perhaps we need not distort the Copyright Act to forbid it. As discussed at the outset, Aereo's secondary liability for performance infringement is yet to be determined. They've never even gotten to that issue in the case. As is its primary and secondary liability for reproduction infringement. If that does not suffice, then assuming one shares the majority's estimation of right and wrong, what we have before us must be considered a loophole in the law. It is not the role of this court to identify and plug loopholes. It is the role of good lawyers to identify and exploit them, and the role of Congress to eliminate them if it wishes. Well, Congress can do that, I may add, in a much more targeted, better informed, and less disruptive fashion than the crude looks-like-table TV solution the court invents today.
Well, it sounds like Justices Scalia, Thomas, and Alito merely said we shouldn't have taken this case in the first place, right? That's what they're saying. Having taken it, we shouldn't make a ruling?
I think having taken it, we should find that there's no performance going on here is what they would say. Under the technology that they're reviewing, the three dissenting justices rejected this whole notion that we can't look under the covers or behind the scenes and that would be unimportant. What's only important is the impact, because in other cases, we definitely look under the covers. Yeah, we definitely look at what the technology is doing. In the Cablevision case that blessed the notion of a remote DVR, how the technology works was very important, and whether the users were directing the performance,
in the position of the content creators, the networks. What if somebody were to take Twit and rebroadcast it in some form, charge people $8 to do it, add to my audience, great, but in a way that I can't count and monetize it. I would be pissed off. And I think I would have a right to recourse.
There are plenty of podcast apps that maybe rebroadcast or use.
They do, and our rule with those, like Stitcher is a good example, is they have to, they cannot keep a copy of it on their servers. They must merely provide an interface to our copy, which we count. So they don't cache our content. They just provide an interface to get it, which is fine with me because I can count it. But I've always had the rule that if somebody comes along and says, and by the way, there's that guy in LA who has that, what is that bizarre business where he's rebroadcasting stuff completely illegally over the internet. He rebroadcasts us. It's my position that because I can't count that rebroadcast, he's not his right to do that.
Right. And
is it not?
I think we're talking apples and oranges is the problem. We're not talking about free over-the-air broadcast TV brought down by an antenna and whether it matters who has the antenna. We're talking about something completely different, a piece of video that you put out under a certain license and certain uses are allowed under that license. You also make it embeddable via YouTube. So, you know, being able to embed around the internet is fine if you're doing it.
So because I don't do Twit over the air for free, it's not related. It's different.
I think it's different, yes. Yeah. I think that one of the things
the fact that FilmOn.tv, and this guy, I don't know why this guy's still in business, rebroadcast Twit, and by the way, everything else it looks like in the world.
So he copies and rebroadcasts, or does he embed?
Copies and rebroadcasts.
Yeah, so that's, I think, pretty clearly, if you know, I'm not here to give the network legal advice, but I think if you consulted with a lawyer, you might find that that could well be actionable.
So the difference is, because he copies and rebroadcasts it. And Aereo has always said this, well, our business is to rent an antenna.
Right. Our business is to rent an antenna.
But isn't that what the cable company's business was?
It was, but it was one antenna on a hill,
see.
The fool on the hill, being shared by many. And we're not talking about that situation here. We're talking about much more, I think, the Cablevision situation where was the particular user directing the particular recording on the remote DVR, that decision was never taken up by the Supreme Court. They had the chance to decide that that was wrongly decided in one way, and they didn't do that. So it's still the law until the Supreme Court decides otherwise. And I think they've kind, you know, the majority decision doesn't even really address that they may have monkeyed around with that. And in fact, went out of its way to say, we're not touching the DVR aspect of Aereo's business. That's not in front of us right now. But I think you can't really get around the fact that their decision impacts not just remote DVR services, but potentially things. Professor Eric Goldman has a great article on four unanswered questions that the Aereo case leaves. And one of those unanswered questions is, well, if we're not going to look at how things work technologically and whether technologically they comply with what we've decided is okay under the law or not, then things like embedding could well be jeopardized. You know, it's hard to tell if that film on is embedding or copying. You have to go behind the scenes and under the hood to figure that out. And, you know, should it matter? Well, the law has always said that it does. So it's a dangerous precedent in that way.
I hate to get in bed with Scalia, Alito.
Embrace the Sicilian, Leo.
And Thomas. And say that basically Aereo is like a copy store with library cards.
Yeah, that's not the greatest analogy.
Doesn't really. I feel like if these are the guys we're going to say, oh, they got it right? Huh? Tim, you haven't said a word. What do you think?
Well, it's because I think Denise has got a pretty good lock on the situation. You know, my non-legal gut instinct is that I tend to agree with the dissenting opinion here. I mean, I think it is a loophole that's being exploited by Aereo, but I think that it is ultimately a loophole. And, you know, I don't know where you draw the line. If there's one antenna for me that somebody else is leasing to me and that's legal, you know, if there's two antennas that somebody else is leasing to two people and that's legal, you know, at what point does it become illegal? And of course, as you mentioned, if indeed this is all a bit of a lie and all those antennas are acting in series, then that's a different story altogether.
Does that change things? You know,
in my eye, it absolutely does. Yes. At that point, then there's no doubt that they are breaking the law. But, you know, taking things at face value and assuming that they're not lying to us, then, yeah, I don't see why this would not be the same as just having a bunch of separate antennas and leasing those individually. So I am a little bit disappointed by the ruling, but ultimately I'm not surprised at all by the ruling. This is pretty much how I expected it to go down.
So just we're going to wrap it up. But just to get clear in my mind, Denise.
Yeah.
If it's kind of like a hypothetical, if what they were doing is just passing it on, like the consumer's choosing the channel, the consumer's choosing what to watch, Aereo is doing nothing but letting them do that and pass it on, that would not be a public performance. That would be legal.
No, I don't think that's quite what the court in the majority decision said.
Did the court give any direction to Aereo about how they could make this legal?
No, did not really. Just looked at what it was doing and said,
so you can't do that.
We think you're like a cable company and what you're doing is skirting the law. You know, we had some cases on the books in the late 60s and the 70s that embraced what you were doing, you know, in the form of what the cable companies were doing then.
The cable vision.
And we think that Congress in 1976 expressly enacted, they, it goes so far as to say, we think that Congress enacted the 1976 Copyright Act specifically to undo these two decisions that the Supreme Court had deciding that cable companies were not publicly performing. And it just decided so much that what Aereo was doing looked like what they were doing, that there it ought to be treated the same way. And I think, although this does not come through, it is not expressly stated in the opinion, I think there must have been some sort of underlying concern that if we go ahead and say that this is not a public performance, then the cable companies, all they have to do to get out from under all the must carry and retransmission fees and licensing consent requirements that they are under now, the very heavily regulated industry that they are, all they have to do is adopt an Aereo-like technology and they're golden. They're no longer cable companies either. And I think the court was concerned about that kind of thing. Again, this is just my guess on that front.
In the oral arguments, they were very concerned that whatever decision they made would impact services like Dropbox. Do you think that the decision they've made, I think you brought this up too, Natalie, the decision that they made now does put Dropbox in a tenuous position? Or no, it protects Dropbox.
Are you asking me or Natalie?
Well, I'll ask you, Denise, then I'll ask Natalie.
All right.
You're the lawyer here. We're going to put you on.
That's the question. I don't have the answer.
Yeah.
I think the court is trying hard not to jeopardize services like Dropbox or Google Drive and to say, hey, if you're not dealing in free over-the-air broadcast television, we don't apply. This decision won't apply. But I'm not quite sure. And when you read through the dissent, there are good arguments why it's difficult to draw lines. You know, right. it's going to be fuzzy to what's a public performance. And as Justice Scalia says, it looks like this standard will sow confusion for years to come. And I think that we will see some confusion around what constitutes a public performance after this decision.
But it is what the Supreme Court's job is to try to infer what the intent of the legislation was and to enforce it in a way that's consistent with the legislation, right? I mean, they're not overstepping their bounds. That's what they do.
But they also know what they do is set precedences,
right,
which is why I think Scalia was so uncomfortable saying, we're trying to ensure that this won't set a precedence, but we cannot assure that.
Right.
Right. And if Congress intends for things that aren't cable companies to be treated like cable companies,
they
maybe Congress should say that.
They should say that, not the court. But this happens all the time. The court's always making decisions about what it thinks Congress meant. That's a lot of what the court does, right?
Yes.
Fox exactly. is already using Aereo's defeat as ammunition against Dish, by the way. They're revisiting a case they already lost, saying, but wait a minute. Maybe we shouldn't have lost this, and they're going back to the court. Mm-hmm. So this is just the beginning. Fox's lawyer Richard Stone wrote a letter to the court saying, Dish, which engages in virtually identical conduct when it streams Fox's program to Dish subscribers over the internet, has repeatedly raised the same defenses as Aereo. Those defenses have now been rejected by the Supreme Court. They're trying to have the case reheard. Okay. A couple of things to point out. Yes, of course, Aereo was trying to take advantages of loopholes. You could call them loopholes or just the way the law was written. They worked very hard when they first created the business to, you know, create a business that was legal, that was based on the law.
Mm-hmm.
Some have said, well, that's wrong. You know, their intent was to circumvent, but, you know, they try to use loopholes to get away with it. But, hey, that's what happens. Every company does when they try to avoid paying taxes, too. You find the loopholes and you use them. That's not illegal. And their intent, if they, the Supreme Court's not ruling on the intent of whether they intended to violate copyright, right? Or are they?
Well, there is this volitional aspect to copyright infringement, and it comes into play in the Cablevision case, and whether the user is doing the selecting or the intermediary technology entity. So it comes into play there. And if you're just passing through and allowing the user to do the selection, you know, I mean, query whether it really makes sense to be able to go after all of Aereo's users for copyright infringement. But that's, you know, what we've seen in the movie industry, in the music industry, in other similar situations. So yeah, you might find yourself in that kind of weird world. But the other thing that could have put Aereo on the hook, getting back to direct liability or indirect liability, is if it's inducing users to infringe, then that's what did away with Grokster.
Right.
So
Grokster didn't infringe, but because they gave users the ability to infringe and incented them to do so, it was deemed illegal.
Right. So the direct infringement thing is what's really problematic here.
The other thing I think that comes up is that a lot of people are upset with the decision, not on the law or the merits of the law and whether the Supreme Court's right or wrong, but just because they wanted Aereo to succeed. I think that's the vast majority of geeks. We just wanted this way to do this.
Right. Doc Searls put up a good post today, just sort of lamenting the fact that Aereo did not position themselves differently in this case and did not come across not as the, you know, person providing you with a dime size, or the company providing you with a dime size antenna, but instead the company providing you with the ability to actually receive free over-the-air broadcast, because as Doc writes in his post, that's virtually impossible to do in a lot of places. And
Doc, by the way, agrees with me. Yeah. He says the court was right that Aereo should have cleared performance rights with the stations and didn't. But I think he makes the right case, which is that Aereo made the wrong case.
Yeah, Aereo might have wanted to do a little different kind of approach to what their business was.
Yeah. He says Aereo is a perfect example of the marketplace at work. After the digital TV transition, Aereo fulfilled a demand that existed because people could no longer get over-the-air signals.
Right.
If Aereo met a market demand, and that's how these things work.
I don't know that it would have done a lot of good, because that's what the original right. cable companies did too. And right. Didn't whether you anything. Should even consider right. Aereo a cable company is really the crux of this case.
I also think that and sometimes we, in our zeal to get new technologies and to cut the cable and all of this, we forget that people who create content do deserve to get paid for it, do have rights to be protected, that there's a reason why there are patents and copyrights. These are not uniformly bad things. In fact, they're very good things, and they do support innovation. If, you know, innovation comes when you have a feeling that you can make some money on it, that there's a reason for you to innovate, not just because of, hey, it's a good thing, I like to do this, but because it's a business.
Well, I can't help but wonder if Aereo had partnered up with Nielsen to be able to provide ratings and viewership numbers back to the broadcasters, and effectively so that those eyes were counted. If that might have changed things a little bit, because ultimately, you know, for over-the-air broadcast, that's the only way that these companies really have an idea of what people are watching. Cable, they can get views, obviously, and through streaming networks, they can, of course, know what's going on. But beyond that, it's pretty much reliant on Nielsen numbers, and I wonder if they had done something there so that those numbers got back, so that advertisers at least would know what's going on. That might have helped their case a little bit.
I think frankly, if Aereo had gone to the locals and said, we want to retransmit, do you give us permission? This is what a cable company does. Do you give us permission? And the locals say, yeah, but you got to pay me 10 cents a subscriber, and agreed to that. Admittedly, they wouldn't have had an $8 a month service, but they would also be legal. And I feel like that Aereo really set us up. Said, no, you can have an $8 a month service. We just do these things, and magically it's legal. And they've been proven wrong. So for people to get upset...
Well, now you're getting into economics, though, because what is the cost is definitely not what we pay our cable companies. That is not the cost. We pay for a lot of things we do not consume. And so the cost is, if I'm talking on behalf of the user, inflated. But you're right. It's not $8 a month, and it's not $60. Like, the real cost it's
somewhere in between
what we
there,
consume is somewhere in between.
Well, then, in fact, that was an opportunity for Aereo then.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Price it right. Pay the retransmission fees. But still, it'd still be less than cable. And maybe, you know, I don't know. I do feel that, like, Aereo, there was a wink, wink, nudge, nudge in Aereo's business model, right?
I know. I kind of feel like Justice Breyer talking about, we're not going to look at what happened behind the scenes, is kind of like saying, we're not going to look at
right. They're
trying to end run.
No, and he was right not to. That's probably right. The court should probably not do that, because that's hard to determine somebody's intent.
No, I meant technologically behind the scenes.
Right. I think that was also right, because that they would have gotten in the weeds. They don't have all day to do this. They got a lot of work to do.
Yeah. Well,
they're trying to go on vacation, I think you need to look.
Right. They want to go on vacation. They only have October to July. They got stuff to do. They got some fishing.
They're working up against a break. That's why we got two big rulings. We're not agreed, but we got to get out of here. So
I frankly don't think the Aereo case matters all that much, because it seems to me in 5 years, sooner or later, everything will be on the internet. That's where it's going. These last gasp lawsuits are merely an attempt to kind of keep the business model going a little bit longer. But just as with everything else, it's all going to be on the internet. None of this is going to matter in the long run. This is a short-term problem. Aereo was solving a short-term issue. And am I wrong on this? I mean, I understand that cable companies and television companies are going kicking and screaming. But at some point, sooner than later, it's going to all be on the internet.
Yeah, it's just a question of what it's going to cost.
Right.
And
well, that's why Comcast is doing what it's doing to become the evil empire, because they want to make sure that if they can't charge you for HBO and Showtime and a package of stuff just so you can watch the World Cup, at least they can charge you through the wazoo for your internet access. And notice, by the way, if you look at the pricing of cable with internet and cable without internet, cable TV with internet, cable without internet, has come closer and closer and closer. The differential is very small. And it's getting smaller all the time because they know eventually they're not going to be able to charge you for television, but they're going to get it out of you for cable, for internet, rather.
Yeah.
Are we all in agreement that, Tim, do you agree that, what's the time frame you think before all content is on the internet, period?
Yeah, I would say 5 years might even be a bit pessimistic, but yes, certainly in the very near future, at least, you know, here in the United States anyway, I think that within probably 2 or 3 years, we'll see all but very fringe content. You know, like RFD TV, which has cattle auctions and things like that. That would take a little bit longer to get over.
Cattle auctions are the first thing that should go on the internet.
I actually used to enjoy that channel when I got it. It brought me
you
back.
You should come to Petaluma. We got an auction house right up here. Yeah, it's great.
The I know. I walked by there.
I assume you're meeting legally on the internet.
Yeah, legally. And yeah, that's
legally
true. Yeah.
In an authorized and paid
of course.
For fashion.
Everything can be gotten on the internet right now. But legitimately, legally, with the sanction of the content creators.
Yes. Yeah, I'd say 3-4 years in the outset.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when the content creators then break the model so that you can subscribe to one channel without all of the rest of them. Because that's what really pisses us off so much about the cable companies is not so much their service or lack thereof, but paying for things that we don't consume and wanting to, you know, buy a cable package that doesn't include whatever that channel you just were talking about, horse, whatever.
Horse auctions. No, I think truthfully the real people behind this and the ones who are most concerned about Aereo were the cable companies. Because what they, you know, it's not, yes, it was the content creators suing, but I think the cable companies do not want this to change. They need to preserve their power as long as possible. Otherwise, HBO and ESPN and everybody else just go directly to consumers and say, pay us $10 a month for HBO Go. Disintermediate Comcast. Who needs them?
Right.
And yeah. The only reason they don't do that is they're terrified of Comcast.
Right.
They can't afford yet to do that.
Then you get into the legal issues around those aggregating the, you know, wild and woolly world of disaggregated everything on the internet.
Well, that's the way it should
be. If it's not being bundled for you and someone tries to bundle it, that was Google TV's issue, right?
Right.
That you were going to be able to select your CBS and NBC online. No, they didn't like that at all.
Mm-mm. I should be able to buy, forget channels. I should be able to buy Game of Thrones. I shouldn't have to buy HBO. I shouldn't have to buy a package from Comcast. Mm-hmm. I should be able to buy Game of Thrones. And you know what? When that happens, it won't be HBO that's producing it.
You can buy it by episode.
You can wait
iTunes.
A year later.
Right.
But what's happening, and I think the music industry realizes this, is that who you're competing against is BitTorrent. The real competitor is BitTorrent because they're offering it for free in high quality the minute the show ends. Illegal, obviously, right? All right, we're going to take a break because there was a, I think, much more important Supreme Court decision regarding cell phone searches. And again, we'll go to our legal beagle, Denise Howell. Who's going to give us the information in just a moment. Really glad to have you, Denise, from This Week in Law, a must-watch every Friday afternoon on Twit from NBC, the wonderful Natalie Morris. So far, no children eruptions, no puppy eruptions.
Oh, gosh, you just doomed us.
But we do have bird eruptions from Tim Stevens. He's up in Upper New York State. He, of course, works for CNET. Got it right this time. Our show today brought to you by lynda.com, the best place to go and learn what you want at your convenience. Lynda has over 2,400 very high quality courses in every aspect of technology. Whether you're a developer, a designer, a photographer, they even have business classes. things like how to negotiate a contract, how to write a resume. You can learn it all. Watch, listen, practice, learn with Lynda, LYNDA.com. They just released a new iPhone and iPad app for iOS 7 that's just gorgeous. They've also enhanced their Android app by adding Chromecast support. So now you can watch Lynda everywhere, including your big screen TV via your Chromecast. The iOS app has a beautiful visual intuitive interface. Both new apps offer online course and video viewing. By the way, with the courses, you get more than just the video. You also get the transcripts. You can jump right to a particular part of the course if there's some particular thing you want to learn. And you might say, well, I don't want to pay for a whole course if I'm only going to, you know, look at one part. Well, the good news is it's a flat rate. You pay a monthly fee, $25 a month, and you get access to everything. So you can learn just the stuff you want to know. Lynda's instructors are the best in the world, the people we work with in many cases. Great photographers, designers. Burt Monroy, love him, does a great Photoshop show every week at lynda.com. Courses for every level, beginner, intermediate, and advanced. Whether you have 15 minutes or 15 hours, you can learn at lynda.com. Many companies have Lynda, including ours, have Lynda accounts. We're moving to Premiere. We send our editors over there if they want to polish their Premiere skills. It's $37.50 a month for the premium plan. Then you get the exercise files that let you follow along with the instructors. That's great for Photoshop or Final Cut. You can also try it right now with our free trial. 7 days, unlimited access to Lynda, LYNDA.com/twit2. Lynda.com/twit2. You'll get all of the courses at last count. Let me see how many courses they've got online. It's some huge number. You can get every one of those courses, 2,701 of them, many tens of thousands of hours, absolutely free for 7 days. How much can you learn in 7 days? At lynda.com/twit and the number 2, lynda.com. We thank them for their support. I've known Lynda Wyman since the Screensavers days, and they've just done such a good job. So at the same exact time as they released the Aereo decision, they released the cell phone decision. And I think this is very good news for privacy in this country. Even if you have been arrested, the police still must seek, in most cases, a warrant before they can search your cell phone. And we know law enforcement actually has boxes they can plug into your phone and dump all the data off of it. And they do often routinely do that. But the Supreme Court ruled Wednesday that this is, you got to get a warrant. Is that good? Denise?
Oh, it's fabulous.
Yes.
Riley versus California is the case. Unanimous decision of the Supreme Court, which, you know, you get a lot of court watchers saying what that means and if it's really and truly unanimous or if, as you suggest, Leo, they're just
wheeling and dealing behind the scenes. I'll trade you an Aereo for a cell phone.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But yes, here we have the court actually really showing a good grasp of what new technologies mean and how they impact people's lives and the difference between being able to search someone's pocket for a weapon or something else that might hurt an officer during an arrest or something else that might be informationally important to the arrest, evidence that you could gather just by...
it's all on my phone.
Exactly. No, you're gonna find lots of evidence on somebody's phone, but it's gonna be stuff that not only could convict them, that is gonna be a lot of other stuff too.
So the case was a guy who was stopped for a traffic violation. Mm-hmm. They, I guess, must have given the probable cause, seen weapons. He was arrested on weapons charges. The officer searching him seized a phone from his pants pocket. The officer accessed information on the phone, noticed the repeated use of a term associated with a street gang. At the police station 2 hours later, a detective specializing in gangs further examined the phone's contents. Based on photographs and videos, the detective found the state charged the petitioner in connection with a shooting that had occurred a few weeks earlier and sought an enhanced sentence based on gang membership. He was convicted, then appealed. California Court of Appeals affirmed, but the California Supreme Court, but mm-hmm. not the United States Supreme Court. Unanimously, they said that was unlawful search and seizure. So what do we need to do now as citizens? If we are stopped by the police and they say, can I have your phone? Should we just say no?
Yeah, you could.
You smash it right in front of them.
I'll say, you know, in Riley versus the state of California.
Smashing it, not
you
such
eat
a good
it.
Idea.
You eat the phone.
You could have obstruction charges against you under those kinds of circumstances.
Don't do that either. Okay.
But yeah, without a warrant, they can't search your
Actually,
phone. So
if you've done something wrong, give them the phone. Let them say, oh, officer, no, you're not allowed to search that, but here. And then they throw the whole thing out of court. Chief Justice Roberts wrote, modern cell phones, I love this, are not just another technological convenience. With all they contain and all they may reveal, they hold for many Americans the privacies of life. The fact that technology now allows an individual to carry this in his hand does not make the information any less worthy of protection. I love that. That's right on.
And I also like how he said that the term cell phone itself is pretty much outdated, and that these are effectively cameras or journals or, you know, any sort of thing that should and is normally protected by law. And I thought that was a great point that he made as well.
So this, according to the Daily Dot, this review reverses a 5-decade-old interpretation of the law that allowed arresting officers to search suspects' pockets, phones, and anything else within his or her reach. So this is kind of new law.
Yes.
So wait, they are allowed to.
It's just not the same as a pocket. Yeah. And they can. They can still, you know, the seat of your car, your pocket. They can pat you down. You know, if the safety concern of the officers has always been behind, you can go ahead and do a search incident to arrest. But if you're going to search a cell phone, this decision says, you're going to need to get a warrant. And law enforcement was not wild about this decision and fought it because they said, well, particularly in today's day and age, getting a warrant's not going to be effective because what if someone just, you know, you've got Apple, they've got this great remote wipe, Android does it too. We're going to have our evidence destroyed. And the court, you know, really showed a nice grasp not only of the nature of the cell phone, but of how these things work in the decision. It talks about as to remote wiping, there are means to address that. First of all, you could turn the phone off. Then it can't be wiped. Bear that in mind, law enforcement officers. And also you could use a Faraday bag. Would you ever have expected to
see
the word Faraday bag in a U.S. Supreme Court decision?
The fact that they know such a thing exists is awesome.
Isn't
obviously, it was some smart clerk, right, who wrote this decision.
Such devices are commonly called Faraday bags. Wow. After the English scientist Michael Faraday, they are essentially sandwich bags made of aluminum foil, cheap, lightweight, and easy to use. And they show you, then they cite the brief of the criminal law professors that was filed as an amicus brief. So they're reading their briefs and they know what this stuff is.
Or a clerk is, yes.
Yes. They this may not be a complete answer to the problem, but at least for now, they provide a reasonable response, and they talk about that not only that law enforcement agencies know what Faraday bags are and use them and encourage officers to use them, but they talk about the fact that a warrant's a lot easier to get than it used to be too, and that
unfortunately,
and that a lot of law enforcement officers can talk about, you know, can rely on like a 15-minute electronic email response to a request for a warrant. So we're not talking about a whole lot of hoops that need to be jumped through here.
The Daily Dot says, in answer to the question, what should you do? Lock your phone with a passcode. If your phone is locked and or encrypted, according to the ACLU, the police may take your phone, may try to look at it unconstitutionally, but they won't be able to.
They can't force you to put your finger on the identification.
Yeah. If you forgot to lock your phone and don't feel like it, then calmly and respectfully, this will work. Tell the officer his search is in violation of the Constitution under the court's Riley decision.
Yeah, I mean, that Daily Dot article has some great advice about saying, look, if you want to search my phone, you need a warrant for that. If they want to go ahead, though, and do it, that same article says, just go ahead and let them do it. You know what the law is.
But you should out loud state, I do not consent to this search, and make sure the witnesses hear it. I want to make this clear. I do not consent to this search, because then whatever they find is inadmissible.
I got a good question from someone on Twitter along these lines. His name was Mark Jones, and he was sort of keying into the fact that not only, you know, do we keep everything on our cell phones, but we have things like boarding passes. And in his particular case, I guess his insurance card for, you know, showing that he has auto insurance on his cell phone, and asking, if you show that to an officer on your phone, are you giving up your privacy rights to anything else on the phone? I certainly don't think so. You know, first of all, you have to be, if you're under arrest, is the only way that there could even be an issue about an officer's ability to search your phone without a warrant. And just handing an officer an unlocked phone to show a particular item on there, I don't think is communicating consent to search the phone. But again, you might want to say when you're handing the phone over, hey, I don't consent to you searching the whole phone.
I also might mention that the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the ACLU have pages called Know Your Rights, where you can print a PDF about what the police can and cannot do, I presume updated thanks to this most recent decision, and also a PDF of tips when confronted by the police. The thing I want to emphasize, this is not designed to, you know, somehow get gang members off, because the police do have the ability to ask for a warrant, to put the thing in a Faraday box. There's a lot, you know, it's this, you know, if there really is a crime, the police can pursue it. This is to protect our privacy against an overreaching police state. And this is good. Tips for talking to the police. I hope it's... there's a great long YouTube video by You Should Never, Ever Talk to the Police. that I recommend. I refer you to without recommending it. I refer you to if you want to know more. I certainly made sure my kids knew it. So good news. Privacy rights are protected. What do you think in the light of these two decisions? A lot of people were mocking the Supreme Court in the Aereo case, saying, oh, they're clearly technologically out of touch. I actually thought in the oral arguments, most of them, not all of them, but most of them were pretty in touch. Sotomayor showed a real understanding of how this stuff works. I think she knew about Roku boxes and Netflix. So I think that in this privacy thing, they seem very much in touch with what a cell phone is and why it's important to protect. They seem like they are in touch. Yes, Denise?
Yeah, I think they're more in touch than people give them credit for. I do think, you know, you're talking about people in an older demographic who are still, you know, incorporating these tools in their own life and trying to grasp how they work and what they mean and doing their best with it. And they have really smart clerks, as you pointed out, Leo. So I think they do a pretty darn good job. You know, the coffee shop with the library card,
not so much.
Is something a cable company when it's clearly not. They've got some hurdles to overcome still. And it would be wonderful if we could get someone, you know, truly versed in what technology means and how it works and the legal considerations around it on the court. I think we're still waiting for that one.
It's been, you know, kind of a truism in technology for years that legislatures, courts, members of Congress don't really understand the modern world. But I think as the older generation ages out and the newer, younger people get elected and appointed, it's getting better.
It's getting better and it's getting different. You know, I keep coming back. I have a 10-year-old. So I see the world of Minecraft sort of constantly.
Yeah, that's a very different world.
It is, isn't it? And the whole approach to the intellectual property in Minecraft is completely, you know, just not something I think the Supreme Court would be able to get their head around. What do you mean people just create worlds and then everybody gets to use them and there's no copyright and there's no... Right. Enforcement. And so, yeah, I think we're seeing a generational shift.
Absolutely. I do dread the day that everything is an 8-bit Minecraft. So your kids, like, because Michael just, like, he won't stop playing Minecraft. He loves Minecraft. Your kid's that way too, huh?
Oh, he loves it. Yeah. Fortunately, we don't need to put him into a 12-step program for it, but he's a fan.
All right.
We have some specific questions for Chad when you have a chance.
Yeah, Chad's the king of Minecraft, obviously, OMG craft. We're going to take a break, and we're done with the Supreme Court. Thank you, Supreme Court, for giving us a lot of material today. But there's a lot more to talk about, including Google I.O., Apple, Microsoft, and Amazon. Even Twitter's in the news. And I really want to talk about this Facebook study, which apparently I'm the only person upset about. The fact that Facebook tried to manipulate our emotions for 1 week 2 years ago. But that's going to all have to wait till after this break. Denise Howell is here from This Week in Law. So glad to have you. Natalie Morris from NBC. And Tim Stevens from Upper New York State. And CNET. Are you still on a wireless connection, Tim? Because it looks really good.
No, we paid up to our dues to Time Warner, had them run a cable up the hill, and we are now nice. Fully tethered.
Nice. Looks good. I can see your freckles. Never could see those before. I just thought it was an 8-bit problem. All right. right now, it's time for snacks. I wish you all were in studio with me, because I got my nature box here. We sent some to you, right, Denise?
Oh, my gosh. Twice. And they each respectively lasted, if they lasted 3 days in our house, I'd be stunned.
Well, that's why we should just get a bigger box for you next time. Yeah. They do come in three sizes. Nature Box are healthy, great-tasting snacks delivered right to your door. And at your office, even more important, if you don't want your employees going to the vending machine at 3 in the afternoon and getting all sugared up, when they could have delicious treats like praline pumpkin seeds, or if you like more savory roasted garlic pumpkin seeds or dried California peaches, the Lone Star Snack Mix. Nature Box has literally hundreds of snacks. If you go to naturebox.com/twit, you could see a summary of them. All of them nutritionist approved. Never any high fructose corn syrup. Never any trans fats. Nothing artificial. You can even, if you want to drill down, you can say, I only want vegan or soy-free or gluten-conscious or lactose-free or nut-free. You could choose from savory, sweet, or spicy, but do get an assortment, because sometimes you'll look at something and say, I don't know if I really want pear praline crunch. And then you taste it and you say, where have you been all my life, pear praline crunch? My God, the world has changed. This, because I'm going to Hawaii tomorrow. These are, and I, you know what, I will... Lisa will back me up. The best dried pineapples you have ever had. The Big Island pineapple, dried pineapple rings. I don't know what Nature Box is doing. All the Nature Box bags are resealable, so you don't have to eat the whole bag. In fact, you might want to try not to, because as Denise says, it's hard to keep this stuff in stock. These are so good. They're guilt-free. Coconut date energy bites.
You're making me hungry, Leo.
I know. Me too.
My kids go nuts over the sweet potato sticks. They're real sweet potato sticks.
Aren't they great? And you feel good as a mom. You feel good giving them to your kids. It's like, yeah, it's all right.
Good stuff.
Everybody should have snacks. As you know,
good snacks. And I like the dried garbanzo beans are like peanuts.
Oh, you like the chechi. You like the chechi.
Yeah.
So if all you get from this message is get Nature Box, just do it. Naturebox.com/twit. And by the way, we will give you half off your first box, as if that weren't enough. Half off. It is so, I want to bite this pineapple ring right now, but if I do, then we'll have to pause for 10 minutes while I chew it. It's so good.
Maybe we can talk them into sending you more than one box a month. Isn't it just a one box a month service at this point? That's not enough.
You can get as many subscriptions as you want. There's no limit. If you want a box a day, you could do it. Why not? Naturebox.com/twit. I know people who would. How many? We seem to get lots of NatureBox deliveries. Our staff, we feed our staff snacks. We get 3 a month. We might have to increase it. Yeah. We give our snack. I mean, I think this is good. I remember it was a big deal at Tech TV when they cut out the oatmeal. That was like the end of the world. We knew that the business was going down because we used to have the cups, you know, of oatmeal, and you add hot water. And I think half the staff was living on that oatmeal. Rent's tough in San Francisco. And when
do you still have the Biscoff spread?
Do we? Oh, that should be banned. That stuff should be made illegal. That can't be good for you.
What is it?
No.
It's ground up Biscoff cookies. They turn Biscoff. I don't know if you've ever had Biscoff. They're like Oreos, but better, right?
Yeah, no, they're
I don't know what that's.
They used to give them to you on Google planes. It. I don't know if they still do. They're called
so
Biscoff biscuits.
Oh,
and then somebody said, hey, you know what? If we grind this like we grind peanuts, you could make a Biscoff butter.
Mm-hmm.
If you've ever had it, don't if you haven't, because
you won't be able to stop.
You will crave Biscoff butter for the rest of your life. It's terrible.
And if all those people in the studio should run right now to the fridge and start passing the Biscoff around.
Good.
European cookie spread.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just put it in the chat.
I think Jeff Needles ate it all.
All right.
No? Mm. No. He doesn't like. He only eats chicken, unskinned chicken breasts and What is there a vegetable you like? Zucchini. That's right. He actually found a chicken and zucchini cookbook, and everything, he eats everything in that cookbook. That's it. He's a strange boy. Needles? All right. Google I.O. I already showed off the best part of Google I.O., which is the cardboard box. You're right. I found the Dodo case thing, Tim. This is so cool. Dodo case, which makes those great iPad cases, is selling a Google Cardboard VR toolkit for $20. Or add the NFC tag, which isn't that useful, for $5 more. But what it does is when you put your phone in there, the NFC tag goes, hey, and it launches the cardboard app automatically.
And I wouldn't be surprised if we see some better made plastic ones here in a couple of weeks. This could, you know, turn into something of an app marketplace almost. I mean, I could see devs starting to develop games for this sort of system.
Why not? Isn't that the funniest thing in the world, that Google does all this stuff and, like, spends billions of dollars to do robots and autonomous vehicles and balloons with the internet, and it turns out a cardboard box is their hottest product? That would be fitting, wouldn't it?
Well, you know, the IP lawyer in me is just cringing at the fact that someone's already duplicated the cardboard box and is using the Google trademark in marketing.
Oh, my God. Will we see a Supreme Court case?
No. maybe it's the Minecraft world and Google will decline to enforce.
It
but
seems like they don't really need to pursue this one. So you went to Google I.O., Tim Stevens, I know.
I did.
And I guess the thing they handed out at Google I.O. was an Android Wear watch. You had the choice of the Samsung or the LG, right. And then later you'll get the Moto 360. So which one did you get?
I went with the Samsung, which is here. I was kind of curious to see what Samsung would do in the long term with the device. Samsung said during I.O. that they're going to differentiate their device a little bit more. Right now, all three devices do basically the same thing, which is Android Wear notifications plus heart rate and some other stuff. Samsung did say they'd be bringing some of their functionality to this device, and I did like the look of the Samsung a little bit better. The LG's is more square, more blockish. It looks bigger, even though they're the same size. The tapered bezel on the Samsung, I think, looks a little bit nicer. So I went with this guy. But ultimately, in terms of functionality, at least, they're very, very similar devices right now.
That's actually one thing I found very interesting. I think it was Ars Technica quoting Google's head of engineering, that they are going to, unlike with the Android phones, that Android Wear, Android Car, and Android TV would all be exactly the same.
Android Auto, in particular, you have very little control in Android Auto over the look and feel of your apps, and that's by design. I actually spoke with folks from General Motors and Audi to get a little bit more information on that. But ultimately, you know, when you are talking about something that you use while you're driving, it's very important for that not to be distracting. So Google worked very closely with those auto manufacturers and with others to design a look and feel for the interface that's going to be consistent. It's going to be the kind of thing that you can extend a little bit, but ultimately they're not going to give developers the opportunity to change the look and feel of those apps. So if you go between Spotify and Play Music, for example, the apps look exactly the same, except the colors change and the logos change. So all the developers can really do there is basically change the orientation of the buttons. They can, you know, change which buttons are there, but there's always going to be the same row of buttons across the middle and the same basic layout. So that's so that you can kind of get some muscle memory going, and so that you can't create an app that is distracting. There's been a lot of kind of fear this week about people joking about people creating video games, you know, running 2048 right on your dashboard, that kind of thing, but that's simply not possible.
Well, it also avoids the toxic hell stew, as Microsoft call it, or was it Apple? I can't remember. Somebody called it. Andrew Cunningham, writing at Ars Technica, says it's not just auto. Android Wear and TV will not be skinnable. They will always be the same version. Updates will come from Google directly. Andrew says he talked with Google engineering director David Burke, said all the new Android initiatives announced at the keynote will have user interfaces and underlying software controlled by Google. And that's the deal you make if you're LG or Moto or Samsung. I think that's good on the one hand because you do avoid fragmentation. You do know what you've got. Certainly in an auto application, that's very important. But even for the watches, you use one, you'll know how to use the other. This is what Microsoft did with a Windows Phone. But on the other hand, it does kind of limit the innovation in the ecosystem.
Right. And manufacturers can still create custom apps, of course. They can still deploy custom content. So Ford, for example, could write an app that only works on Ford cars through Android Auto. Samsung can write apps that will only run on Samsung watches if they want to. That sort of thing is fine. But yeah, when it comes to the core aspect of the operating system itself, that's locked down. And I think just about any Android fan will probably say that's for the best. And of course, when it comes to watches, there's so many more opportunities to personalize the devices, much more so than phones now, which all kind of more or less have shaped it or morphed into the same sort of device. It's really difficult to tell phones apart these days. But watches, there's a lot more room for differentiation, especially when we look at the Moto 360, which is round, versus the other two, which are not round, of course. That's another opportunity for manufacturers to differentiate themselves.
But really even with the round interface, the cards are going to be the same cards. Just the corners will be cut off.
Right.
That's interesting. I wasn't at Google I/O, so I didn't get a free one, but I did order. I decided not to get the Samsung because it's Samsung phones only, right?
Mm-hmm. I believe so, yeah. I haven't tried with anything else, though.
Yeah, but LG is cross-platform and work with any 4.3, any Jelly Bean or later, 4.3 or later maybe. So that's good. That means it'll work with my phone. And they even have you can even go to a website on your phone and check compatibility, and it'll tell you if it's compatible or not. Okay, so look, we've all seen every one of these stupid devices from the Jawbone, the Nike, to the Pebble. I've had the Gear 1, the Gear 2. All of them have kind of left something to be desired. Is it your experience, since you're the only one who has one, Tim, on this panel, that this is any better than those?
It's very different than those. Ultimately, it's doing a different sort of thing right now, which is really focused on notifications. I actually think this is closer to Google Glass than to most of the smartwatches that we've seen so far, because really it's focused on notifications first and foremost, and there's not really a lot else that you can do with it. You can do a pedometer on here, and you can get your heart rate, which is no better than on any of the other Gear devices, which is to say not very good. But there really isn't a lot else that you can do right now.
You can talk to it, right? If you get a text message, you can respond because it has a microphone.
You can do that if you want to. I haven't really met anybody who wants to be talking to their watch yet, so I'm not sure the value of that to a lot of people.
You look pretty dorky, but hey,
yeah,
we're used to that.
But you can. I mean, it is nice to be able to say, give me directions to whatever to your watch, and then have it pop up on your phone. That's kind of nice. And I was also, for example, the contextual stuff is very good. So I was flying back from San Francisco here to Albany on Thursday night. And the watch not only gave me the weather in San Francisco where I was, but it gave me the weather here in Albany where I was headed to, and it gave me the weather in Detroit where I was connecting, which I thought was an interesting
touch. Because it knows your itinerary.
That's awesome.
Right. It knew all that, and it pops up.
Did it show you your QR code for your check-in, or does it?
Doesn't do that yet, no, at least not for Delta. So I do think that'll be coming in the near future, and I can't wait to confuse the security checkpoint people with
they have it on my watch.
A thing on my watch. Yeah, exactly.
They already breathe a deep sigh when you come up with your phone.
Yeah,
they
absolutely.
Another one of them.
I think that'll be here probably in the near future. And there'll be a lot more apps coming too. I mean, there's obviously space for loading apps to your phone in the app that you run on your smartphone. So I think that will be coming in the near future. But right now, it's very much the same sort of interface you see through Glass, where you get pop-up notifications.
It looks like Google Now, really, is what it looks like. Is it all the same stuff as Now, or?
As far as I know, yeah, it's all the same cards that you see now. In fact, if you bring up Now, you'll see pretty much the same list of stuff. It's just on your wrist, of course, and it's a little bit more dynamic, of course, because you get those notifications in real time, and you kind of feel more inclined to look at them as they pop up.
I like that. Package notification. So it's telling me right now on my phone that I have 6 minutes to go home if I wanted to go home, because it knows where I will go after this show. It shows me birthdays of people who I follow on Google Plus. It shows me the Giants score because I know I care about that. The TV show that I watch, it shows it's on tonight. Shows me my stocks. And articles that I've searched for in the past, I guess, and the local weather. And you know what? It's doing the same thing you just described. It's telling me the weather in Petaluma and in Maui. Because it knows that's where.
I just got a notification that Denise Howell just tweeted about me. So that just popped up here on the watch, too. So you get pretty much any notification that shows up on your phone will show up here, too. So developers don't need to do anything extra to integrate here. So I use AnyDo for tasking.
Love AnyDo.
And those pop up.
Those pop up, too.
Now, presumably, AnyDo can then extend their app and provide more functionality through the watch, right, which I'm looking forward to them doing. But for now, those notifications will come right up.
I'm excited. I want one. Natalie, is this something like, does this, have you, you, I know you've used all those other things.
A little bit. I get tired of them pretty fast.
Me too.
There was a statistic that came out recently that said that I think it's like 45% of wearables are ditched within 6 weeks.
Yep. 100% of mine.
For a while, and then you're like, forget it. And, you know,
I've
and
spent
I'm
thousands on these
things.
Not completely
bought into the like radiation on your body type stuff. So I just don't think we know enough about that kind of thing. So I like to play with it a little bit, but also I just don't think they're cute enough. I like watches for fashion. My phone does all of that stuff. So. But it's not that I don't think that there's
a
market for it.
I've sort of enjoyed living watch-free for a long time now.
Well, you and everybody else, we all, watches right. were superseded by our smartphones. And it is so much trouble to get the smartphone out of your pocket.
It's a first world problem.
It's absolutely exactly. a solution to a first world problem, for sure. And I do think that we'll see new applications and new reasons to wear these things beyond just notifications. But yeah, right now it's very much I can't be bothered to reach in my pocket, or I can't be bothered to dig into the bottom of my purse to pull my phone out. And that's obviously not
a problem. Oh, you have that purse problem too. Yeah, when you
I
have
do.
So
it's
stuff.
A large purse. There's so much stuff in there.
I can never find anything.
Since Boho is back in, those big bags.
How about you, Denise? Would you buy one?
I don't think so. I'm kind of like staying on the sidelines for the various watch functionality things to see what happens with them and how useful people feel that they are. You know, I'm good with my phone and already feel, you know, silly enough talking into that. don't know that I necessarily need to talk to my watch. Although I think that we do need a world where the watch and the car and the phone and everything's integrated, and whatever technology people like to interact with works in a unified way and works well. So, you know, I kind of see what Google is doing, exerting a little bit more control over the Android ecosystem here. The thing I just notified Tim about is our same tweeter that let us know about the what are those things called?
Dodo case?
Dodo case. Yeah.
Cardboard,
so G. Rajib again sends us the developer's file for the Google Cardboard and the schematics and everything.
Yeah, so Google published it. Yeah.
Yeah, Google's put all this out.
And it's a cool site. If you scroll your mouse around, it'll actually show you the whole thing. And this, by the way, I think the Dodo case guys just took it exactly from
right.
there.
Right.
These are like those kits that we do with my kids on the Home Depot on the weekends.
I think that, yes, like a birdhouse. I did that with my kid. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's no hammering involved here. You do need a neodymium ring magnet and a ceramic disc magnet. And apparently 45 millimeter focal lengths lenses, which are hard to get. But so I think the Dodo case will save you some time. They also give you developer documentation. So, and this is exciting. You can write your own apps for this stuff.
Yeah, should be a lot of good stuff out there.
I think that these wearables, though, is really that the technology is there. What we really are waiting for is for them to become fashionable. Because a watch and glasses, these are accessories that, you know, the technology companies are going so crazy to try and make them better and better. They're already okay. What we really need is for these to become desirable in terms of fashion. And maybe that's why we see so many executives from the fashion world now coming over to technology. And that's been an aim for many, many years now. There's been HP has been working with Vera Wang for, you know, we've seen these partnerships, but it's not there yet. I don't want a Wi-Fi dress, but I've been in the market.
I do want
a Wi-Fi dress?
Yeah.
How about a Wi-Fi moo-moo for your trip tomorrow?
Does it go with me? Like the Wi-Fi follows me around in the dress? I want that. I think that's
good. Yes, your dress like is a Wi-Fi.
We know you can order pizza because they demoed that on the stage with the Android. Is everybody just waiting? I know what's going on here perfectly well. You're just waiting to see what Apple's going to do.
I think that's part of that is true. Yeah. I want it to be better looking. I think
you're going to get the Burberry iWatch.
Yeah.
I need it to be better looking, actually. I need the stuff to work well. I want my car and I really want this whole, you know, universe that we're just on the verge of when the car works the way you want it to. You can know whether your lights are burned out and what your thermostat's doing and all that stuff. It just sees easy and seamlessly, and I don't think we're quite there yet.
Yeah. Just the other day, I had one of those little lights in my dashboard and I'm flipping through the stupid book and I'm like, why is the technology that I have to figure out what this light means? Yeah. Come on.
It should just, your phone, your watch could tell you that. I see
probably
you have
could.
A light on.
Yeah.
And so there are some things that they talked about as well when it comes to Android Auto. For example, if you have navigation open on your phone and you're directing somewhere and you plug your phone into your car, the car will basically pick up navigation right in your dashboard and take off where you left off effectively. But if you're not navigating and just plug your phone in, it won't start navigating anywhere or it won't even take over the display of your car, for example. So there's some contextual stuff coming in there, which I think is interesting. And of course, with Nest kind of getting in the game, I think we'll definitely see some good stuff when it comes to smart home integration as well. So I think there's a lot more contextual stuff that's going to be coming in the near future. But yeah, right now the designs do leave a bit to be desired. These watches are all very big. I do think
they don't look well. They don't look great on women's wrists and smaller wrists. They look pretty clunky.
My wife is very eager to get a device like this, but whenever I have one, she tries it on and it just looks kind of ridiculous on her, unfortunately. So she's still waiting for
the one. Her arm.
The thing for a while was women in masculine watches. Was in style.
Yeah,
for a while.
So were shoulder pads.
Too bad they missed it.
We've moved on, thank God. Well, let's talk about auto because it looks like what Google is doing is very similar to what Apple's doing with their, what do they call it?
CarPlay.
CarPlay. That they're casting it into the car. So since you're the car editor over there at CNET, fill me in. What does the car have to do? Audi just announced, for instance, the 2015 models will support Android Auto.
Right. And this is another bit of fear, uncertainty, and doubt that's been thrown on this week is that your car will probably support both of these standards. There's a lot of people saying that you might have to buy one car or another based on what phone you have, but it's very likely that manufacturers will support both because ultimately, from a car manufacturer standpoint, they're very, very similar. All they need to do is basically run a very simple software stack in their cars and then provide a USB input and the means for video stream to come from your phone to your dashboard. And that's pretty much all that they need to provide, plus a couple of buttons and some other stuff.
So CarPlay works basically the same as Android Auto? It's the same?
Basically exactly the same thing. So what the phone is doing is effectively rendering an external display, and then that content is showing up on your dashboard. And then voice commands and touchscreen or physical buttons, those stuff get then push back into your phone, and that controls the apps. So it's very much the same between the two. The big difference between CarPlay and Android Auto is that developers can get in the game when it comes to Android Auto. They cannot do that when it comes to CarPlay. Apple is basically locking things down and saying only our approved developers can write apps for CarPlay, at least for now. Android and Google are giving developers the permission and the means to write apps, but in a very limited way. Right now, only media apps and messaging apps are allowed. And again, as I said before, they have to fit into the standard templates that Google has defined. And those templates are approved based on global standards for distracted driving and that sort of thing. So, for example, no single interaction with the app will take more than 2 seconds. Those are things that are globally accepted, and those are things that are now approved and included within the Android Auto standard. Now, there's another standard called Mirror Link, which does the same sort of thing. You plug in your Android phone, it connects and takes over the dashboard of your car. That allows developers to do anything that they want to. They can write any apps that they want to, but those apps need to be certified to run in the dashboard. So that's even more open than Google. But what Google didn't want to do is force developers to learn all these standards when it comes to button size and contrast and allowable fonts and things like that. There's a giant stack of certifications that you can read if you really want to. Google said, we're going to kind of get rid of all that stuff and just basically create a template that's allowable, and our devs had to fit within that.
It seems like a lot of interaction with the screen that it kind of fosters distracted driving. I presume that they're going to be very careful about that.
Yeah, they're absolutely. I mean, GM and Audi and all the other 40 members had a very big part in saying what exactly these apps can look like. And so these apps are all basically going through the same sort of standardized testing that any of the head units for a General Motors car, for example, would go through. They have to abide by the same rules and regulations as those things. So while, of course, the demonstrations that we've all been getting this week, it shows a lot of people staring at these screens, hitting buttons and things
that
scared
me.
As we're playing with it.
Yeah.
But anything can be done by voice. They can all be done by steering wheel controls as well.
Okay.
The car supports it, and there will never be more than, I think, about 10 buttons on screen at one time. They're all fairly large, and they're all in the same place, so you can get muscle memory going, too.
Will the Google Voice capability be the same as it is on a phone? In other words, can I send a text and tweet?
You can reply to text. I don't know if you can create a new text, though. That I'm not sure about.
So it may not be the same capability.
Right, but you can do searches for content across apps, too.
Right.
Maybe you described this, but what about when you don't have a good connection when you're driving out in the sticks?
Oh, you're screwed.
Stall?
You're going to get lost. So you're going to end up. Yeah, you're dead meat.
Because so, the technology for a GPS is much different. You can actually get mapping when you don't have reception, but that's not the case with these mobile devices. It's a completely different mapping technology.
It would be just like Google Navigation now, where you, if you have connection when you start and you lose connection along the way, that's fine because it'll cache the path that you're going along. Or if you downloaded that map to your phone locally, which you can do now, you can then navigate within. The other thing that the system can do, because it talks to your car, it can actually pull GPS data from the car. It can pull speedometer data and wheel position data from the car too. So, you know, if you're walking through the city or if you go through a tunnel with your phone, gets really confused because the GPS sensors and phones are pretty weak compared to a car. But if the car loses signal, the car can still get a pretty good idea of where it is based on where it knew where it was before and based on how fast and in what direction it's traveling. So even if you're driving through a tunnel, you'll still get better navigation through your car with your phone than if you just had your phone out.
I like that.
Tim, can I ask you a question? Do you think that car companies are going to embrace this because technology companies can do it better, or do you think they'll get defensive because they have their own sorts of things they've been developing?
They're going to embrace it very reluctantly, but they don't really have much of a choice at this point. They've been trying to develop their own systems that would be better for years now, and ultimately they've failed. And in fact, I've been interested to watch all the poaching from these consumer tech companies that the auto manufacturers have been making, hiring a lot of mobile developers to help build their software and to improve their software. But, you know, when you're talking about software that goes into a car, the integration cycle on those things is at least 3 years, more like 5 years most of the time. And so even if they're doing cutting-edge stuff, it's 3 years away from showing up, and that's a problem. There are solutions to that, but the best solution is simply to take that stuff out of the car, put it in the phone, and then you'll get a much better experience because that can be updated more easily. So the manufacturers know that that's what people want. Manufacturers don't really want to hand that control over. They want to control the dashboard as much as they want to control the shape of the steering wheel and the shape of the headlights and everything else. But this is something that people are really going to demand in the next probably 24 months from now. This is the sort of thing that people are going to expect from their cars. So GM and Ford and everybody else are going to reluctantly have to support it.
They have to be very careful. They don't want legislatures. They don't want Congress to start passing laws about this stuff, though, because of distracted driving. They've got to be really, really cautious.
Yeah, that's the other thing, too. I spoke with manufacturers about that, too, and they are definitely afraid of that because they feel that that will stifle innovation.
Absolutely.
I think that definitely would.
Yeah.
So I think that they are taking the right steps, especially Apple with CarPlay and Google now with Android Auto. They're being very careful about making sure that these interfaces pass all the regulations that are out there and well-defined now. Right. And those right now are industry-defined regulations, but they are very comprehensive. So I hope that we don't see any more legislation coming because that would definitely throw a big old wrench in the works.
So, Michael Klein, you stop watching Twit as you're driving up here on your... How did you get your Pioneer to do that? Did you hack it? No? Sort of?
Messed up.
Sort of.
I can show you later.
Yeah. He's busted, except he tweeted it.
Yeah,
you do know the Twitter is...
It looks like that was taken
you need
from
a warrant
the back
to
seat,
read someone's
though.
Twitter feed?
It was from the back seat. That's right. He
it
wasn't driving.
Read someone's Twitter feed.
Very, very good. Very good. Very good. Google announced a lot of other stuff. This was a 2.5-hour keynote that seemed like it would just never end. There's the next generation of Android, Android L, with a beautiful design. I thought beautiful design changes. Looking forward to that. Android TV, which is their third attempt. Actually, fourth, if you include the ill-fated Q, to get Android in the living room. I, though, thought there were a couple of things that they showed that maybe they didn't fully explain how they worked, and I thought could be very interesting. One was the idea that you could use, forget Android TV, you could use your Chromecast to do a lot of the things that you would do with an Android TV, including cast applications, play games. It's unclear how they're going to do this, when they're going to do this, but this is pretty neat.
You can replicate your display, or you will be able to replicate your display to the Chromecast. And that's functionality that I was kind of shocked that they didn't include in the first place.
Right.
But they are bringing that now. I don't know if it'll be across every Wi-Fi chipset and every device that's out there. But that'll definitely make Chromecast a lot more usable, I think, for a lot of people.
Also, you'll be able to cast to somebody's Chromecast without joining their Wi-Fi network. And we've now learned that that's using inaudible tones to authenticate with the Chromecast. Coming from your phone, the Chromecast is listening, apparently.
That's really cool. It's getting that sync up with the Wi-Fi network. It's always a pain.
Yeah. So now you can just sit on the curb and change somebody's channel. I thought that was really neat. Apparently Google acquired the company that does this audio authentication last year, and this is the technology they're using. Although they didn't mention that at all in the keynote, these ultrasonic tones.
I love Chromecast, but I feel like it's such a geek tool. You know, are any real people using Chromecast?
That's a good question. It seems so easy. You just put it in the HDMI port. You use your phone to set it up. Then you use your phone to find content, and you cast it to your Chromecast, which then receives it and puts it on your screen. What could be easier?
Right.
It's only $35. Yeah, no, there. The normal people I know can't even figure out how to turn the TV on, so this is not.
Much less where the HDMI ports are. Yeah.
What is an HDMI port?
Right. My dad thinks it's HTML.
Yeah, that thing that does the internet, the HTML, I got it on my TV now. It's amazing. They also showed, and I thought this could be huge, again, they just did a little quickie, the ability to run some Android apps on your Chromebook. They showed Evernote, Flipboard. And I'm not sure, they didn't really say how this works, but it strikes me if you can run Android apps on your Chromebook, they've added this kind of same app capability to Google Chrome, the browser on Windows and Mac. It's just a short amount of time before you can run Android apps on your Windows machine and your Mac machine as well. And that this is really what the keynote was about. Android everywhere. Good strategy for Google.
Yeah,
pretty obvious strategy.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, they had Chrome OS too, but Android seems to be the killer.
Especially as they're trying to build dependence on things like Android Home and Android notifications, you know, you want that data to be everywhere that you are. And so for them to be able to extend Android apps across all these platforms, I mean, you get more dependent on those Android apps. And as your accessibility and visibility into that data gets broader and easier to access, and that means that you have more opportunities to use that data, and you become ultimately more tethered to their ecosystem.
That's good for Google.
Ultimately, what they want.
Absolutely.
So yeah, I think it's absolutely great, and I think it's good for the users too. I mean, that simple example of getting weather in Detroit on my flight back was ultimately a useful thing. Not that I couldn't have gotten to that in some other way, but to have it right there on my wrist was pretty nice. And I think that's the kind of thing that we can just expect to see in the coming years.
Ben Thompson, who's been on Twit before and really think the world of, he writes a blog called Stratechery and a newsletter. Pointed out there is a difference between Android on the phones and Android on other things like your wrist, mainly that phones are a must-have. The primary difference between a watch and your phone is you buy the former, the watch, by choice, and the latter by necessity. And I think that's a very good point, that these other devices are more of a luxury item. You can't expect them to dominate in the same way Android has dominated the phone market.
And you can't even use your Android Wear watch without an Android smartphone,
right,
or Android device of some sort. And I should clarify what was said before. The Samsung Android Wear watch will work with any Android 4.3 or above phone, not just Samsung.
You know what? Let me check, because what I thought when I went to the Play Store, it said that it was Samsung phones only. So I must have misunderstood that. But let me check Android Wear here. Let's just click this and look at the Samsung Gear Live. That's the watch. And where did I see? Maybe you're right. Maybe you're right. I thought I saw text that says with any Samsung phone, but I guess that's not the case. So good. That's good news. I ordered the other one, but.
Of course, throughout this whole discussion, I've been wondering about how the Supreme Court would think about your watch.
Yeah. Can they search your watch without a warrant?
Yeah. But it seems like these devices mostly push you information rather than you having stuff stored on there.
Right.
But let's say you're getting pulled over by an officer and your hand is on the steering wheel. And as the officer is talking to you, you get a notification on your wristwatch that says something that incriminates you. And the officer sees that. Is that probable cause in that case to search your phone?
Well, if it's in plain sight, they don't need a warrant. You know, if your watch is there broadcasting, here's the picture of you with the crepes.
Exactly. You know, so turn off your smartwatch and you get pulled over by the police.
But do they need a warrant to swipe, or can they just,
to swipe.
I think they should have to have a warrant to swipe.
Yeah. If it
involves don't touch my watch.
Deeper access, I would think that it would, you know, again, this decision that came out and deals with phones, but there was a lot of good language in there indicating that, you know, we have a lot of devices in our lives that have deep information about us, far deeper than anything that we could keep in our pockets. And a watch may fall into that category.
One thing Google really has to worry...
Speaking of falling in, you can hide it a lot easier. And there are a lot of cavities in your body to put it in pockets. And, you know, you can get creative if you're really that nefarious. I'm just saying.
Next time you see Becky Worley, like she has a story about that. You should ask... Just next time you see Becky Worley, just say, where's the strangest place you ever saw somebody hide a watch? And just let her let her talk. You won't believe it.
Okay, then.
You got to think like a criminal if you're going to...
Think like a criminal.
Be ahead in this world, right?
Yep.
Not that you actually exercise these things, but you're always one step ahead.
Plan ahead. Avoid circumcision. That's all I'm saying. Okay. You know what I'm saying here?
It's time to come out of that rat hole.
Yeah. Time to move on. I think we've covered, Andrea, the only thing I wanted to ask is if the creepy factor, where are we on the creepy factor with Google? Is this, because really this is moving Google more towards a world where instead of you searching, it pushes to you the information it thinks you want on your wrist and your glasses, in your car, in your TV set. Have we raised the creepy factor or not?
But what Google user is going to be like, oh my gosh, they know who's emailing me and who's calling me and texting. Like, what? We expect this of Google. I don't think any of this was like, whoa, that's above and beyond.
Was there
any one thing there?
No.
Fitness stuff. This is so much more innocuous than Google Health, which everyone was pissed off about. Like, I think they've dialed it
back. By the way, they're bringing that back, but you're right. It's not. They're not going to violate any FDA rules or need even FDA permission for this new stuff. Farhad Manjoo talked to Larry Page and Sundar Pichai after the keynote, and there's a really good Bits blog post on this. And one of the things he did ask about was creepiness. And he says, do you worry the more devices we have that are connected to Google, there's not just a privacy question, but also something like creepiness? Page, I think, had the right answer. He says, as long as we make these things useful, people will accept them. He says, the problem is when we talk about things before people see them, there's a much more negative reaction. It's really important for people to be able to experience products. Otherwise, you fear the worst without seeing the benefits. That seems sensible to me. If you can see Google Now and the value of Google Now and use it, it won't bug you as much as if you just hear about this idea that Google will tell you, oh, hey, there's a great deal on pizza down the street, and I know you like pepperoni, so let's go. Right? Do you think that he's fair on that?
I think so. I think that's fair. Part of what makes that Facebook research study seems partly bad, because there ultimately was no net benefit for Facebook users coming out of that study. Right. And that's why I think there was such a negative reaction from that. Whereas with all the predictive search things we're getting out of Google, those are helpful things. And so therefore we're getting a service from it.
He's saying the right words. He says, this is Larry Page again, I'm not trying to minimize the issues. For me, I'm so excited about the possibilities to improve things for people. My worry actually would be the opposite. We get so worried about these things, we don't get the benefits. I think that's what's happened in healthcare. We decided, largely through regulation, that data is so locked up that it can't be used to benefit people well. We don't mine data, mine healthcare data. If we did, though, we could save 100,000 lives next year.
I believe that.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and I think the other piece of this is the other shoe to drop from the Riley decision. There's a lot of speculation about, well, you know, if the court is recognizing that we have this strong privacy information on our phones and the information that can be accessed from our phones, you know, how much protection does the cloud have, and is the NSA surveillance constitutional? And I think that's a strong piece of how much people are going to trust cloud services. You know, if you're putting all your information there, who gets to see it? Who gets to use it?
Page says he's worried that the media and governments are stoking people's fears, and that we'll end up in a state where we could benefit a lot of people, but we're not able to do that. Now, that's a little self-serving. This is Larry Page from last year, where he said, I wish there were an island we could go to. And then
maybe Maui.
Yeah. I'll meet you there, Larry.
Street view it.
No mention of Google Plus, no mention of Google Glass, no mention of Google Home or any home initiatives. Doesn't mean they're not doing it. In fact, Paige in this article says, no, we're all in on Google Plus. We're very happy with it. I think that this was a long enough keynote there. It's been a long enough segment. We're going to talk about the Facebook case. I think there's a few more things to talk about before we wrap things up. You know, before we go to the ad, though, and by the way, I really want to thank you, Anthony, for filling in for Chad Johnson. Chad is on vacation. He went to Birmingham for, a Minecraft convention. So got Anthony Nielsen filling in. But before we go to the ad, Anthony, let's see what we let's see what you missed. If you missed anything on Twit this week, it was a good week.
Previously on Twit,
unbelievable! Oh boy,
tech news tonight.
Google I/O developer conference, of course, and here is the one and only Jeff Jarvis.
The phrase that really resonated with me today was talking about the wearables. Now, computer, you can wear a computer on your body all day.
This Week in Law.
Aereo pretty much is done.
I think what you see here is some issues about the court trying to deal with this new technology through this method of analogy.
I really don't think we should be all that surprised if we can take as a given that the court wanted to see this as a cable company from the beginning.
This Week in Google.
For years, Android did feel a little ill-designed, a little clunky. These new tools are obviously designed to address that.
I think that the complaint that Android is just not as pretty, or not as aesthetically pleasing, I think that that's a done deal.
MacBreak Weekly.
I'm really starting to believe that there's going to be a normal-sized phone that's larger than an iPhone, and also one that's kind of like a Pop-Tart.
Twit. It's free when you watch from work.
You've discovered something very odd.
No one makes tech fun like Chad and Leo on twite.tv.
Oh, my goodness. Awesome. I don't know if Mike did. He did not. Okay, so normally we would say, here's what's coming in the week ahead. We're so exhausted from the week gone by that we're just going to forget it. I don't know if there's anything coming up. I'm not even going to be here.
It's a holiday week anyway.
It is. It's the 4th of July. Let's just relax, set off fireworks, explode things. If you're not in the United States, you could explode things anyway because it's the 4th of July here. And all bets are off. Our show today brought to you by Personal Capital. Really a clever idea. I talked to its founder, Bill Harris, on Triangulation a couple of years ago. And he was looking for a way to help people make better sense of their financial life so they can make better decisions for their future. And he's come up with this great free secure tool that is so cool. It's Personal Capital, and it helps you in a couple of ways. First of all, of course, it's hard to keep track of all your finances, your stocks, your investments, your charge cards, your bank accounts, your property, all the things that you've got. They're all on different websites with different logins. Personal Capital collates it all in a single page with easy-to-use, easy-to-understand graphs and information. And then, of course, it helps you analyze what you're doing. Are you paying too much for financial advice? Have you allocated your assets properly? Are you invested properly so that you can retire when that time comes? Some of you are young enough that you're probably not thinking about that. Now is the time. In fact, I told Chad that, and Chad's been using, I think he's been using Personal Capital. Now's the time to start thinking about retirement, because if you start putting stuff aside now and you do it right, you won't have to worry. I love Personal Capital. Signing up just takes a minute. It'll pay big dividends right away. Total clarity, transparency, make better investment decisions. And by the way, if you do use their financial advisors, they are not on commission. They're all certified financial planners. They're fee-based, but you don't have to use them. It's absolutely free. PersonalCapital.com/twit. It's a smart way to grow your money. And I strongly suggest you sign up and try it today. I've been using it for 2 years, ever since I talked to Bill, and I'm thrilled with it. It's just really, really great. Do you know how your 401k is doing this year? Do you know? Maybe not. Maybe you should. PersonalCapital.com/twit. Okay, the crumbs. I don't know if I even want to mention this story about Tim Cook. I'm not going to. I'm going to take the high ground. Who the hell cares?
Hell yeah.
Hell's yes.
I don't care.
It's stupid. And I don't even know why it's a story. Of course, now I've everybody going, what did they say? I don't know. I don't know.
Google it.
It's none of our business.
It's none of our freaking business. That's right. Let's talk about the Facebook thing, because I think maybe I am upset for no good reason. It turns out Facebook participated in a study, an interesting study, about how what you see on social media affects your feelings. And it turns out that in, I think it was January 2011, for 1 week, Facebook intentionally manipulated the news feeds for 700,000 users. They gave half of them happy stories, half of them sad stories, and then a week later monitored their posts to see if they were happier or sadder. And surprise, surprise, people who saw depressing, sad stories were more depressed. And people who saw happy-go-lucky stories were happier. First of all, what a waste of time. That's obvious, but okay. This was, by the way, Cornell was involved in this. I think California University involved in this study. Experimental evidence of massive-scale emotional contagion through social networks published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of the Sciences of the USA. But Princeton University was a woman who edited it from Princeton even said, the creepy factor was off the scale here. Is it in normally in research, when you do this kind of research, you get the consent of the subject. You may not say what you're going to do, but you say, we're going to do a research study. Just want to make sure it's okay with you.
And when you don't, you have to get consent from a review board. That, and this study did, which...
Yeah, but you know what the review board was? It was Facebook's own review board.
It was an it was a local institutional review board.
Oh, so it wasn't Facebook?
I don't think it was Facebook. I think they went through the proper
How
social
did this happen?
Science channels.
Don't you
have to.
Don't you feel like this is incredibly invasive and
yes.
and messed up? I want to use a stronger word, but I'll use the messed word. Messed up.
Yes, because how much different is this than the Stanley Milgram experiment, which
was messed up.
Yeah. That was the impetus of review boards. That's why we have them, is because when you manipulate someone's psyche to think the world is one way that it is not, it has lasting effects on them, even if it's something as stupid as your news feed.
This is, as the researchers pointed out, part of Facebook's terms of service.
Yeah. And that's what I was going to say. Don't anybody think that it's illegal.
It's not illegal.
I'm sure they covered themselves on that front.
This is what Facebook said.
Ethics and legality are two different things.
Yes. Unethical, maybe. Legal, absolutely. When users sign up for Facebook, they agree their information may be used for, quote, internal operations, including, I hope you read this carefully, troubleshooting, data analysis, testing, research, and service improvement. Now, of course, the other point to be made is that Facebook is constantly manipulating the news feed in ways that we don't know. Who knows what the hell they're up to? This makes me want to quit Facebook so bad.
And they did this two years ago, which is also disconcerting to me. And there was a statement posted just about an hour ago from one of the data engineers from Facebook, kind of explaining things a little bit better and apologizing and saying that they wish that they had been a little bit more communicative and transparent for the reasoning. But he said, you know, we've learned a lot and grown a lot in the past 2 years, so we're better at this now. But still, there has been 2 years of this sort of activity. And that's, I'm wondering what other studies are still in the pipeline and haven't even been published yet. But I do agree that I think that they were not acting ethically here, but to play devil's advocate, how is this different than a website using an A-B test to decide which headline they should run for a given story? I'll throw that out there.
Well, I can tell you one thing. Facebook got sued over Beacon. They're going to get sued over this.
Good. I hope they do.
I think they will. I mean, Professor James Grimmelman, who is far more knowledgeable about this sort of thing than I would ever pretend to be, has said, you know, if you're exposing people to something that causes changes in psychological status, that's experimentation and requires informed consent. Should, anyway. So, I mean, he's just kind of spitballing as a law professor, but if he's spitballing as a law professor, there are plaintiffs' lawyers out there who are putting it in pleadings and probably thinking about filing
as a class
action.
Mean,
the Beacon,
because you wouldn't know if you were part of the 700,000, right? How would you know that?
Right.
If you're
I just
not,
was
though,
really sad. January 2011. I was so sad for a week.
And all of my, yeah, I don't know. You'd have to go through and say, assuming you'd even have a record of what was
I just
shown
think
to
this
you on Facebook then.
Is the only takeaway on this is a little peek under the curtain at how Facebook runs its business, how they are ethically, how they feel about you as a Facebook user. And just, you know, understand we've learned something here. Just, I don't know. I always feel bad when I visit Facebook. I just feel crappy afterwards. I feel like I should take a shower.
Do people think that A-B testing is a psychological experiment too? Because ultimately you're trying to influence someone's psyche to get them to click, and you're using different headlines to basically influence their decision.
It's no different than you go to a restaurant, the chef says, do you like this or this? Is where the eye doctor says A or B. It's just you giving somebody a choice, and the choice isn't explicitly requested or explicitly given, but you just see, well, do people like this side or that side? That does not feel as manipulative as somebody modifying the news feed to try to make me happy or sad. That seems
right.
really
messed
up.
And these researchers had to go to Facebook and say, our hypothesis is that
it will.
The emotional content of your Facebook feed will affect your emotional content, your emotional response. So we intend to manipulate this in order to elicit emotional responses from your participants. And that is very different than just seeing what color looks best on your banner. Wouldn't you say?
I don't know. I mean, isn't that the same thing as an editor going to another editor saying, I believe that if we change the headline to be this structure, that we'll get more people to click on it. So therefore, let's run both using some optimizing software with A-B testing capabilities, and we'll see which one is more effective. And therefore, they're going to learn which is more effective. Again, I'm playing devil's advocate here, but
I effective is a different thing because these authors have specified to Facebook that we would like to emotionally manipulate your users. And they said, yes, it's not a matter of which ones, you know, get the most clickbait, which I agree does happen. But when once Facebook
got this,
but
you're physically motivating the user
abstract,
if they have to take the mouse and click on it,
then they should have said no.
Well, the good news is fewer than 0.1% of the users committed suicide. So it's okay. Well, I don't know, but that's a legitimate question. What if somebody got so depressed they harmed themselves because of this stupid study. Then what's the liability?
And there's one other thing out of this is that I'm not sure that they actually proved anything, because if indeed you're seeing sad news, you might say, oh, I'm really sorry to hear about that. And then ultimately you
right.
are contributing
you
to their
sad.
Research. But that doesn't necessarily mean that yeah. you're actually any sadder yourself.
Right. Yeah, it's dumb. The whole thing is dumb. And by the way, you mentioned, Natalie, I did quit Facebook once. I wish I weren't on Facebook, but I feel like I have to use it so I can report on stories like this.
Yeah,
I need to have an experience. So I'm taking the hit for you.
How did this come to
taking
light?
It for the team.
I'm taking one for the team. I don't want to use Facebook.
He's taking a profile for the team.
You know what? I did give up, though, and I'm very proud of myself. That stupid Simpsons tapped out.
It's taken a while.
I was really hooked on it for a while, and then Electronic Arts crashed it, and I was actually relieved. For 6 months, I couldn't use it. Then all of a sudden, Lisa said, oh, your tapped out seems to be back. And I went,
oh, no.
Oh, no, they keep pulling me in. And I, for the last month, it's been about a month, I've been doing it. And I realized that it's like an hour a day I'm farming and tapping. So I'm very proud of myself. I just and Lisa did too. We deleted our Simpsons tapped out. Because Farmville 2 is coming, and I really want to have room on the iPad. No, just kidding.
Did someone out Facebook, or did they out themselves on this research thing?
The paper was published.
Ah, there we go.
Somebody started reading this. What? You did what? Now all of the, I think there will be more. We will hear more about this.
You know, people need to vote with their feet if they don't want to be experimenting.
I want to vote with my feet. I want to quit Facebook. I think this is ridiculous. Finally,
I'm not gonna.
Blubber.
I would like to.
Blubber has set a new world record. He played the entire Super Mario Brothers game under 5 minutes, 4 minutes, 57.69 seconds, beating the previous speed run by 0.4 seconds. It is, ladies and gentlemen, an official world record. Congratulations to Blubber. Thank God he doesn't play Simpsons Tapped Out. We could sit and watch this for, it's only 5 minutes. Seems like that's slowing him down. Like the load is slowing him down. They didn't say what platform he played this on. That is just weird. Ladies and gentlemen, with a name like Blubber, are you surprised? Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, Denise Howell. We appreciate it every week. This Week in Law is, a voice for sanity and understanding how all this stuff works. And I am so grateful to you for doing that every week, and especially when things like Aereo happen. So I appreciate you being here, Denise. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. And please, people, realize that The Internet's Own Boy, the movie documentary history of Aaron Swartz, came out on Friday and is available for everyone to watch, and everyone should watch it.
Is it on Netflix? Is it, where can we see it?
Amazon and Vimeo, and I think iTunes.
$6.99
donated to the Kickstarter campaign, you probably already have the ability to watch it on Vimeo. So amazing, amazing film. Incredibly important to pay attention to organizations like the EFF and Public Knowledge and the Center for Democracy and Technology and the Electronic Privacy Information Center and all of these great advocacy groups that are out there trying to make sure that our rights are protected and that laws work the way they're supposed to, as they didn't in Aaron Swartz's case.
Such a sad story and such a loss, frankly, to all of us. Thank you, Denise, for reminding
me. Sorry, don't mean to put a downer at the end of the show. But
no, I wanted to plug this, and I'm so glad you remembered, because it really is a big deal. The Internet's Own Boy, you can search for it. You can buy it for $6, $7 on Amazon and other places. And it's well worth seeing. And it's not a downer. It's sad what happened, but I think it's important to understand it.
Definitely.
Thank you so much, Natalie Morris, for being here. She is at NBC. Anything you want to plug besides that fabulous Read Quick application?
Read Quick is it. We got a new promo up that you might want to watch that explains the speed reading app for iOS. And that's about it.
ReadQuickApp.com. And the promo is the demo video, so people can watch this and understand.
I don't think it's up on the site yet. I'll put a YouTube video in the chat. We'll put it up. It'll be up by the time
you see this.
We just finished it.
Good. Yeah. Exciting. Yeah. When you say you mean you and Clayton?
Yeah, we're a big team of two.
You go in the backyard and you do a little video, maybe some action figures. That kind of
no, thing. Our no? faces. We don't use the moneymakers. It's animated.
The moneymakers we keep for ourselves. Thank you, Natalie. Always a pleasure.
Really. Yeah, thanks for letting me play, you guys. It's always fun to talk about the news, and this was a good week to join in.
Yes, sure was. Yes. Thank you. Tim Stevens, automotive editor at CNET. He's actually editor at large. He covers whatever the hell he wants to cover.
And, it's very true, and I'm excited to announce that I'm going to be doing a video series on the Google Lunar X Prize this summer, which is going to be debuting on Tuesday, and I'm going to be on CBS This Morning Tuesday morning with the president of X Prize to talk about it. So if you happen to have a TV through Aereo or otherwise, I would recommend you tune in and check it out.
All I get on Aereo now is... Thank you, Tim, Natalie, Denise. Thanks to all of you for being here. Thanks to a great live studio audience. Always a pleasure. If you want to be in our studio audience, email tickets at twit.tv. We'll put a chair out for you. And maybe if we can get in a few more of these cardboard boxes, we'll put something under the chair. That'd be kind of fun. But if you and we always like you watching live on the internet at live.twit.tv. We do the show Sunday afternoons, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time, 2200 UTC. And if you're in the chat room at irc.twit.tv, we can have interactions, we can talk, we can be part of the same thing. If you can't watch live, though, don't worry, because we make on-demand audio and video available on filmon.com, and at twit.tv, and wherever podcasts are appropriately and legally aggregated for distribution to your device. Thanks for joining us. I'm going to take the week off next week. Father Robert Ballaser will fill in for me. Is that right? Yep. He'll be doing the show. And I'll be back the following week. I'm here today, but I'm gone to Maui. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time. Another twit.
This is amazing.
Bye-bye.